I remember so much about how good to my family and to us my dad was. We never lacked for anything. My dad worked every day of his life without asking any questions and not questioning, I should say, why and what he was doing. And he just did so to serve and love his own family. Perhaps the best thing that my dad did for me was to love my mom by serving her sacrificially, demonstrating his devotion to the family by loving my mom. And I'm proud to have my dad's first and middle name as my two middle names, because one middle name is never enough, right? I go by Daniel Harold Charles Williams. Harold Charles, my dad's first and middle name. And my parents told us a funny story that my dad's parents were trying to choose between two names for him, Harold and Robert, but they chose Harold because Robert was so old-fashioned that they went with Harold instead, which is so funny and mind-boggling. But either way, I'm proud to have my dad's name, and more than that, I'm proud to devote myself to his legacy of modeling sacrificial love to my children's mother and elevating her needs above my own, and letting that represent really the way that God has portrayed fatherly love, that he does for us without any conditions, and he has sacrificed himself to demonstrate his fatherly love and win us over. And so we welcome all of you dads. We're grateful for a day like today, and I don't really personally need our calendar or our U.S. government to remind me to honor dads, and I especially make sure my kids remember to honor me every day. I don't need just one day, but for our culture, we recognize that it's a special day for dads. We've been talking about giving, giving everything, with the idea that in our Christian faith, God asks that we give everything, but Jesus teaches that we give everything, recognizing that we do so to gain more. And Jesus tells the story about a traveler who discovers a treasure of infinite value, and he buries the treasure and then goes back home and sells everything that he owns in order to buy the field where the treasure was, having given up everything he had to gain something even more valuable. And Jesus makes this case that when you give up your life and you give up your wealth, you're not sacrificing, you're actually gaining something even more than you had. So what it costs pales in comparison to what you gain. And Jesus teaches this principle called the treasure principle. And we have been walking through six of the keys, and we'll do keys 4, 5, and 6 today, with this idea that we start with giving God our life. Right, we start as his created human being who gives him our hearts, we give him our lives, we give him our soul, and then he gives us new life, and we have everything we need as it's provided by him, and it's only natural to give of our wealth. So I've been talking about giving as a means of spiritual maturity, as a means of responding to the grace of God. And the big idea today is going to start with this: God gave you. He is the source of, he's responsible for, he's the owner of, and your life changes when you believe that God owns everything. If you don't believe God owns everything, then you see Christians or churches or church leaders as on a money grab when they're trying to help people be givers. Because if you start with God owns everything, then it's a natural step to just see yourself as a manager, or more of a kind of a Christian word, I think, that is kind of even better word for manager would be steward, that we are responsible for taking care of and managing what God has given us, but he himself is our source of all we have. So we're managers, not owners, okay? So, and we recognize that God gave us all that we need. We have enough. He always is faithful to provide exactly what we need, and we have enough. And he does so that we can be rich in generosity. That's why we have what we need, so that we can give the excess in generosity. That's why God gave us what we have. And we do this by trusting in him and not our wealth. In fact, here in this big idea, we'll see this in the scripture text in a couple of minutes, that actually in the scripture, here's what we're taught, that we should trust in our money, or sorry, in our God instead of our money. They're compared side by side as if we trust in one or the other. And then Paul says, because money is so unreliable, but God, of course, is infinitely faithful and reliable. So trust, meaning where our, don't trust in our money, don't rest in or rely on or hope in our wealth, but instead trust in God. Had a fun little experience yesterday taking Josiah, my youngest son, for some ice cream, and just when I thought they couldn't do anything more gimmicky with ice cream, now you can buy it all rolled up. Have you seen that? They smooth it out on a frozen sheet, and then they curl it into rolls, and you can have ice cream rolls, right? And believe it or not, it tasted exactly the same as ice cream in a scoop, but it's twice as much money. So I took my son Josiah, and he has a bowl of ice cream rolls, and it's stacked up nice and high, and he gets what he wants, which is Oreo mint, of course. And we sat down at the table, and he's going to eat his ice cream rolls. And just in case, I had grabbed an additional spoon for myself. And I said to him, buddy, can I try your ice cream? And he says, yeah, sure, which he's always said ever since he was little. He's been known to go around the house with what he has, asking his siblings if they want some, which has got to be, I mean, something's not right. I mean, I don't know what happened to him, but he's a very generous little guy. And so he slides it to me and says, yeah, sure, of course, Dad. And while I took my first little scoop, I started to have these thoughts like, what would I have said if he said to me, no, not really, this is mine? I mean, what would I have said? Because I was kind of rehearsing in my mind how ridiculous it would be for him to say, no, you can't have it. And I was starting to prepare a little kind of, they call it lecturing, I call it teaching and training, but I started to prepare a teaching and training in my mind that started like this. So wait a second, let me get this straight. And good fatherly teaching always has a touch of sarcasm. So let me get this straight. Dad just used his own resources to purchase this product and bring it to you and serve it to you. And so technically, who's the owner? It would be me, and you're the consumer. And then I, as the owner, ask you for a little bit, and you say no, that I, even though I own it, I can't have any. Is that what we're... Now, fortunately, I didn't have to spring that on him. I'm going to save that one. But, I mean, can you see how wild it is, the idea that a child would say to the provider, you can't have any, when it came from, was provided in its entirety? He didn't do a thing to get it except pick out what kind he wanted. And it started me thinking along the lines of, this is all of life's generosity. If you start with the belief that God has provided everything, it actually is odd. It's odd to keep anything for ourselves, much less everything for ourselves. It's odd because, and of course, I happen to believe that if God provides it and he owns it and he asks us for a spoonful, I think obviously it kind of triggers me to think that it's a joy to give any of it back or to let it be used for whatever purposes. And God, of course, does the same thing. Look how he describes it here in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 and 19. This is what God is telling Paul, the apostle of the church, to teach the pastor of the church. Here's what he says to do as it relates to what we have, our stuff, our wealth. He says, teach those who are rich in this world not to be proud and not to trust in their money, which is so unreliable. Their trust should be in God, who richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. Tell them to use their money to do good. They should be rich in good works and generous to those in need, always being ready to share with others. By doing this, they will be storing up their treasure as a good foundation for the future, so that they may experience true life. So get this, as a pastor of a church, Paul the Apostle says, if you're the pastor, you have a responsibility to speak to those people who have wealth, and I want you to teach them and tell them. Teach them and tell them how they are supposed to look at their own wealth and how they are supposed to treat and function with and in their own wealth. So Paul gives the pastor, the overseer of the church, the instructions to address, talk to wealthy people. And by the way, that's all of us, right? I mean, you probably have come across this statistic that says that 50% of the world lives on $2.50 per day. 50% of the world. 80% of the world lives on $10 a day. And that leaves the rest of us in the 20% who lives on more than $10 a day as the world's wealthiest people. Would we agree that here in kind of our Western developed world that we are the most prosperous people in the world? Would we agree that we would be considered the world's wealthiest people as industrialized Western nation? And Paul here is saying, teach wealthy people not to be proud and make their life about themselves. Teach them that life isn't all about you. Don't place your trust in wealth. Instead, place it in God. How many of you would be willing to say that sometime in your life, you discovered the hard way that your wealth isn't reliable? Anybody discover that? Instead, place your trust, rely on, rest in your trust. Place it in God. He gives richly to all, gives you all you need for your enjoyment. Tell wealthy people, use your money like a tool to meet needs. Tell them to be rich in good works. Be generous to people who are in need. Have your antennas up and be in tune with who has needs. And if your needs are met, then use your excess to meet their needs. He says, tell them to store up future treasures that last, and you will experience true life and true joy. So he gives me here in this local representation the responsibility to teach and tell. Most people don't like to be told what to do. Would you agree with that? Speak for yourself. Most people don't like to be told what to do. They don't. Especially when it comes to, here's what you should be doing with your wealth. I have noticed that this is prevalent in the church community, that we've kind of adopted, as it relates to our money, a don't ask, don't tell philosophy. Let's not talk about money. Don't ask me, don't tell, don't ask me, and I won't tell you. And it's kind of becoming more and more odd to me that we're comfortable as in our church environments, our church families, we're comfortable talking about other things more so than we are talking about our own money. We ask questions about one another's marriage, one another's medical diagnosis. We'll ask one another questions about spending time in the Bible, or maybe even some questions about the levels of intimacy in our own lives and marriage. We'll ask hard, probing questions because we love and care for somebody. In fact, some of us might even urge one another to be sharing our faith and ask how that's going, but stop short of asking any questions about how someone is doing fighting the battle against materialism. Or if we're willing and able to give for the expansion of God's kingdom and meeting the needs of the poor and enhancing and strengthening the local church. Paul even says that there are gifts. There's gifts of teaching and prophecy and healing and so on, leadership. And then one of the gifts he mentions is giving, right? And we're very familiar with giving people a platform who have the gift of teaching and prophecy. We talk about if somebody were healed, we would say that this person received a healing, that God is on the work through the gift of healing somebody. But the question I wonder sometimes is, how do we teach and train young believers to give if the people with the gift of giving are in a don't ask, don't tell culture? Where would they get it modeled? Where would they learn how much giving means to our own discipleship and our own growth and spiritual maturity? In that environment, where a don't ask, don't tell environment, we would lack the communication, the accountability, and the modeling. Where would someone go to see what giving looks like in the life of a true believer who's following Jesus? And I recognize that most of it's to avoid bad motives or to give for the sake of being noticed, but as it relates to that, it has eliminated completely any conversations about letting our light shine before men as givers, as people who are giving to help people see and praise God in heaven when that gift is given. So we talk about what's happening in the church through teaching, through the gift of healing, even restored marriages and nearly everything else but giving. We know prayer warriors and we know Bible nerds. I'm looking at several of them, but how many of you know somebody who is a giving warrior? And they're held up to say, these people are investing in the kingdom to their great joy and the glory of God. They are giving people as to inspire people because they have a gift and they inspire us to kind of live up to the same devotion. I wonder, so we rarely hear stories of people giving the most valuable time, their most valuable treasure, and their most valuable talent to God. And the reason why this is so vital is because Jesus says, beware, be on guard, be alert that there is something called greed, or we might call it materialism, a possession obsession. One phrase that's relatively new, I think, is called affluenza, a disease that is clearly, it is contagious. It is not hard to catch affluenza. And it comes with it the negative behavioral and psychological consequences or characteristics or effects that come from having pursuit of material objects and things. For the excessive materialism or a desire for wealth and its associated negative emotions, frustration, stress, and anxiety as it relates to having more and maintaining more, getting more and maintaining more. So materialism basically is this. It's the idea that the greatest value, the greatest object of one's affections is something. It is a thing. It's an item. It could be cash, money, a bank account. It could be financial security, and it could be just possessions. Materialism says that's the highest pursuit. That would capture our time, attention, and our devotion. That's the highest pursuit. Now get this, materialism is the opposite, not the opposite, but is in great conflict with Christianity, which says these things are going to perish. They're going to rust is going to destroy them, that moth is going to eat them, that eventually that's going to be burned away, and that instead there is something more valuable to devote our life and identity to, and those are things in the spirit, the soul and the spirit, the unseen things. So materialists and Christians would be at odds. That universe is more, the universe is more than just matter, that it in fact has a true spiritual and an intellectual existence far beyond. So, what do we do? There's three keys I want to cover with you today, real briefly. Three keys that will help us live this treasure principle out. And here's where we start. Number four. We did three last week. Here's four, five, and six. Number four is this. I should live today, not for the dot, but for the line. And the dot, of course, representing your life, and the line representing eternity. That here on earth, we live for one or the other. The dot, our present life on earth, but you see that there's an extended line that goes on forever, which is eternity in heaven. That there is a true life, a real life, that is an eternal life that's everlasting, and that, of course, is way beyond the dot. So how do we stop ourselves from being stuck in the dot? How do we stop? How do we get out of the rut? How do we, most of us don't wake up and say, I am so in wholeheartedly devoted to living my life for the dot. I mean, we don't make that kind of a decision to entrench ourselves in living for the material world, right? We just find ourselves there, and the question is, what stops us from living for the line? I'd like to run two things by you. One is the tyranny of things. The tyranny of things, which basically means this: the more you have, the more distracted you are. Anybody else notice that the more you have, the more time it takes to keep it going and to maintain it? We've decided recently to have a conversation with our four children and say, we're gonna have to let two of you go because we're simplifying our life. It's to minimize distractions. So if any of you have any spare rooms, here's the idea, that the tyranny of things means that time and energy that should go in important places get devoted to less important places just to keep it maintained. Stuff, property, excess. And the minimalists would say, no, we're actually giving away our stuff to be less distracted, for material things and more intentional and more devoted to the things that matter. People who are suffering, relationships and needs and so on. Secondly, there is what the what Solomon in the scriptures calls chasing the wind. Meaning this, the more you have, the more you fill in the blank. What is it? The more you have, the more you want. That means that what you have isn't enough, and when you get what you want, it isn't going to be enough, and you're going to have to actually find yourself desiring more because you have more. One of those famous wealthy people, either Rockefeller, Carnegie, or Ford, Henry Ford, were asked one time, how much money do you need? And they answered this the way. They said, I just need one more dollar. One more dollar. Well, Solomon writes, or the wisest, some of the wisdom of the Bible says that it's like chasing the wind, the accumulation of things. And all of that is rooted in what we would call materialism, focusing on material things as opposed to that which is spiritual in nature. And it's natural to become distracted from spiritual things, pursuing material possessions. And the problems that are created is by an obsession to obtain them and then frustrated by the need to maintain them. And the question that leaves me asking is material success my highest goal? Is that what I've given my most valuable time to, my most valuable energy to? Is my financial comfort and security the highest goal that I have? In fact, there's a lot of trouble with the love of money, right? Which is the root of all evil. The love of money, it's not money. Money's a tool, but the love of money. In fact, Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller said, I've made many millions, but those millions have brought me no happiness. I discovered that my happiness was beyond that. So if affluenza is the disease, here's the question, what's the cure? Are we stuck? We're not stuck. If materialism is the poison, what's the antidote to roll it back, to bring the cure? Paul, the apostle, says that giving is the only antidote to materialism, that giving has been put in place by God to help us overcome the dot or the possession obsession or affluenza or materialism. That specifically, giving helps us experience a generosity, that a willingness to share helps us become rich in good deeds and allows us to take hold of the life, the true life that God has for us, that's beyond the second class life, which would be a life of materialism. The act of giving is a vivid reminder. Get this, here's what giving does. It helps us recognize that our life is all about God, not about us. Giving means, if I'm able to give, here's what I'm saying, I'm not the point. God is the point. He does not exist for me, I exist for him. God's money has a higher purpose than my affluence. And giving is a joyful surrender to a greater person and a greater agenda. So giving dethrones me from my life, and it actually enthrones God, puts him back on the throne of our lives. And it's represented by our willingness to give. So it's the joyful surrender to a greater person and a greater agenda, and it exalts God. As long as I still have something, I still have something, I run the risk of owning it, that I feel like if I have it, I own it. But when I give it away, I really kind of relinquish control. I relinquish the power and I relinquish the prestige. And certainly at the moment, there's a spell that's broken. There's kind of I recognize God as an owner and myself as a servant, and the intended beneficiaries that God has entrusted me to manage and pass it along to. I recognize even more so that money isn't all I can give. We can give time and wisdom and care and compassion and talent, and we can give that, of course, as wonderful gifts to give away. But giving brings down the fever of affluenza. Giving breaks me free from the gravitational pull of material wealth, money, and possessions. It shifts me and to a new center of gravity, which is heaven. John Wesley said about money, money never stays with me. It would burn me if it did. I throw it away as fast as I can so I don't get burned by it. I throw it away. I throw it away from me as fast as I can so I don't get burned by it. So there's three giving phases. I'm going to run them by. Can I give you three giving phases? One's a surrender phase. And then we have a sacrifice phase of giving. And then there's like a surplus phase of giving. And in the surrender phase, God has given this tool to us called tithing, a tenth part. And the idea of tithing is that God would help us learn the surrender part of our treasure to him. And he uses this proportion of our wealth as a means by which he helps us to learn. I mean, most of us love the Proverbs, right? Don't you love the Proverbs? It gives us insight and wisdom on parenting, on being married, and it gives us insight and wisdom on how to be successful and so on. And there's so many ways in which we've found the Proverbs valuable. Parenting. Do you know the Proverbs also says something about our wealth and money? Proverbs says, honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Right? I don't have crops. Does anybody? It's probably don't, but maybe you do. But here's the idea, that the first, that God's children don't give to God last, they give to God first, the first fruits of their wealth, as a tithing principle. Jesus validates the mandatory tithe even on small things, and every New Testament example of giving goes far beyond tithes. So I think that if you look at the Old Testament, you'll notice that there's a specific number. It's a 10%, a tenth part giving. And in the New Testament, it's kind of vague, but here's what happens. Every single moral obligation that we have in the Old Testament, Jesus comes back and validates it plus more. There is no standard of morality in the Old Testament that Jesus shows up on the scene and with his new covenant people, he says, I'm going to lower it. In the Old Testament, the standard is 10%. In the New Testament, the new standard is, of course, the cross. It's everything. It's our whole lives. Jesus raises the expectation of his new covenant children. He never lowers the bar. And what we discover is the tithe is a historical method that God provided for us to help get us on the path of giving. The church cannot require members to give any particular amount of money. Jesus assumes his followers will go beyond the tithe in giving. In fact, what we discover here is that tithing kind of serves as God's way of giving us training wheels for our giving, that it helps us get started. It's a little wobbly, of course. It's not proficient, but we get started with some tithe giving, which gets us on the path of learning how to really take off and really fly, and we get a kind of a glimpse of how it feels to be really moving and starting to ride and fly, and we see that God gives us training wheels to launch us into the mindset, into the skills, and in the habits, and in the grace of giving. It can serve as a gateway to joyful giving, a gateway to grace-responsive giving. It's unhealthy to view tithing as a place to stop. It's instead a good place to start. Tithing isn't the ceiling of giving, it's the floor. It's not the finish line, it's just the starting block. In fact, Paul says that he encouraged voluntary giving and then later refers to people who are being obedient in their volunteering. So get this, voluntary obedience, right? It's kind of a fun combination of words. But voluntarily obedient to God, doing so willingly and cheerfully. The author of the book, The Treasure Principle, puts it this way. He says, it's much easier to live on 90% or 50% or even 10% of your income inside the will of God than it is to live on 100% outside of it. And so tithing, think of it this way, tithing is also, could be viewed as a toddler's first steps. They're not steady, but they're a start. They're making progress. They get going, and it's you wouldn't expect somebody to go from a toddler to go from crawling to running. Instead, there's an in-between, which is their first steps, and tithing becomes that for a believer as they learn to give. And what that means is, I mean, we've talked about this promise card last week. I handed this out and said, hey, we got this vision campaign that we're doing, and we want to be generous and expand our giving and have faith to see what God can do and build, and we do so by prayerfully walking this journey of generosity, and I pray and hope that you're at kind of having this conversation with God, and we're going to be collecting these next Sunday, and so bring these with you. But I wanted to mention this, that promise giving to a vision wouldn't be the training wheels. It wouldn't be the toddler's first steps. That would be tithe giving. And then promise card giving or special project giving is over and above. So I wouldn't start here. If you haven't really taken your first toddler steps of giving, if you aren't necessarily on a training wheel bike of giving, I would start there before I would start with making promises. And so that's surrender giving. Once you learn to ride a bike, you don't need training wheels anymore. Once you learn to give, tithing becomes irrelevant because you're giving above and beyond. And if you can ride the bike without ever using training wheels, good for you, but most people cannot. Most people have to start learning somewhere. How many of you remember that, or would say that where you're at now in your willingness and ability to give is different from where you started? How many of you would say it's different? It's been a journey. I've grown and learned, right? Made progress. God also has another category of giving called sacrificial giving, and that means that there are seasons of life where our giving is primarily making sacrifices and restrictions in my lifestyle, where I'm kind of trimming back what I want, living on what I need, and I give regularly out of sacrifice. Tim Keller says that if we have tithed and it doesn't cut into the way we live, we need to give more. But if we have not tithed yet and our giving does cut into our daily lifestyle, our consciences can be at rest. Sacrificial giving. This is more basic than tithing, and these are people who give even beyond their abilities, and it entails sacrificing daily lifestyles, how much I spend on my clothes, my travel, my home, etc., my Starbucks habit, whatever it is. Thirdly, there's surplus giving. That means that God has provided more than what I need, and now I have a surplus, fruitfulness, to give away, and I'm now in a position where I am giving away more than I keep, more than I keep. This is hard for us. Would you agree? This is hard for us. It's hard for most of us. Very few people find this easy. It's difficult. And there's reasons why it's difficult. Starting with Jesus saying that where your treasure is, that's where you give. And most of us, our treasures are here on earth. Our treasures are our kids, our home, some of the other essentials in life, our financial security and our inheritances that we leave to our kids. And Jesus said, your money's going to follow where your heart is. And if you always give most effortlessly to that which you believe to be your own comfort or salvation, then clearly you're going to be giving towards those things that you find are the most meaningful in your life. Those are the things that you hope in. Those are the things that you're comforted by. Your real salvation is where you invest your money. And that's why it gets hard. If Jesus is the one who saves you, your money flows easily into his work, into the lives of his people. If your real hope is your appearance, your status, your comfort, your giving will flow more easily into those items and those symbols, and giving will seem very difficult. Here's what we discover, that God knew this from the beginning, that generosity was going to be a test of our heart, not a test of our wealth. It's going to test our heart. And Jesus, by the way, sees the tithe as so concrete that it helps us to be able to tell if we're giving and investing for God in biblical proportions. And we know this because he criticized the Pharisees that they only tithed, that they didn't have a heart of compassion and generosity. They only tithed in order to be, they were kind of got-to givers, right? They were trying to make sure their resume was complete, that they're that they were doing what they were supposed to for recognition. But Jesus says your motive should not be to satisfy the requirements self-righteously, but instead to do over and above out of a heart of generosity. And God has entrusted us so much. And I love this too, that God doesn't expect us to be guilt givers. I'm so thankful that the scriptures don't say, if you have a lot, you should carry a lot of guilt. Right? We are where we are because God has given us a responsibility, I think, to do something with our wealth, and we have the power to be difference makers, so we can feel privileged to give. Rather than being guilt givers, we can be grateful givers. Instead of being got-to givers, you can be a I-get-to kind of a giver. In fact, some people, I recognize this is probably the Pharisees too, they were get-full givers. In other words, they were giving to get something back. But God says, I've given you everything you have. You can be grateful, and in that gratefulness, You can certainly, you don't have to save it, you don't have to spend it, you don't have to pass it on to other people that are going to spend it. Instead, you can be a giver. You can expand it. So here's what God does by giving us wealth. Number six, last one, very quickly. God raises, He prospers me not to raise my standard of living, but instead to raise my standard of giving. He prospers me. He gives me more than I need. Why? So that he can raise my standard of giving, not primarily and exclusively my standard of living. Check out this passage here. When Paul is teaching this to the church at Corinth, he says, you're going to have a big harvest, but I want you to explain why. Here's why you're going to have a big harvest. He will provide an increase of your resources and then produce a great harvest of generosity. Your increases will go up, and then I'm going to stir your generosity, and you're going to have a harvest in generosity. And then next, you see here where he says, you will be enriched in every way so that you can always be generous. You're going to have more than you need so you can always be generous. You can always find ways to give it away. Needs that people have who are suffering, the strengthening of the local church, and to supply everything that you need and what other people need. Those gifts that God gives us will help us give them away. And then here's what happens. He says, then people will thank God for your generosity. They'll thank God for what you have given to them as if it came from God, not from you. So extra money is a blessing, and it's a test. And it's a test to see if I'm going to build my kingdom or God's kingdom. On Memorial Day, I was with my family at a parade, and I had brought to them, I had bought some donuts, and it turns out that I bought about twice as many donuts as my family could eat, which is astonishing to me. And on Memorial Day, I had given myself permission that it was a holiday, it was a kind of a donut day for Dan, and I was going to give myself permission to enjoy some donuts. And after my family ate their share of donuts, we had about a box of donuts left over, and it seemed a lot to me, and I happened to notice a lady sitting by herself next to our group here, and so I turned to her with this box of donuts, and I said to her, would you like a donut? I bought too many for my family. And she said, no, that's okay. And don't you think most people say that initially to be polite? I do, anyway. And I said, no, really, we have too many. We're not going to be able to use it. And she said, oh, really? And before I knew what was happening, she says, oh, okay, I am expecting a group. And both her hands clamped around the box, and she pulled it off my hand and turned around with it. And I was thinking things like, pull it back. Clamp down on it. Go Black Friday Walmart on her. Just start wrestling back and forth with it. So she turns with it like this, and she says, thank you. And she covers it up, and she slips it underneath her chair. And I'm starting to, now I'm like, that didn't really turn out the way that I expected. Today's donut day. And so it gets worse. There it sits under her seat, and as time goes by in the hot sun, I'm watching the chocolate frosting on the Boston cream melt and slip off the donut. Meanwhile, I'm thinking to myself, well, when this group gets here and she's able to, I'm going to be fine, right? I mean, they're just donuts. And sure enough, her group comes, they sit down, and do you know, she reaches in a bag that she brought, she pulls out rubber made of homemade baked goods that she must have made, uncaps them, and starts handing them out while the box of donuts melted away underneath her seat. She doesn't even need them. And I tried to concentrate on the parade, but I'm watching these donuts fade away underneath her seat. So finally, I worked up the courage, and I turned to her, and I confronted her. I'm just kidding. I didn't confront her. I mean, it's obvious, right? We shouldn't regret giving away donuts. Never, ever, ever regret giving away donuts. But it happens naturally that what's mine is mine. And here's what's weird. Even though what's mine wasn't mine and I was actually giving it away to her, as it slipped away, you know what I kept thinking? No, those are mine. Those are mine. What are you doing? And here's, not only Should I regret giving away my excess donuts? The same is true for anything else that goes beyond what I need. And that's the thing. I wasn't giving away. Listen, this is just, it's kind of embarrassing to say this, but I didn't give her my last little flask of water to survive the summer desert. You know what I'm saying? It was excess. And in our hearts, times infinity is the way we respond to keeping what God's given to us, far more important things than our little box of donuts. And my hope is that those are opportunities just like that where I'm in training for my kids to see we give stuff away. I learned that at home. I learned that from our parents. I learned that from my dad, that giving is something that you do instinctively. You give away your time, your talent, and your treasure. And we have to ask ourselves this question. When God gives me everything that he's given me, is he given those things to me so that I can stockpile them or so that I can distribute them to the people who really need something? And our hearts fight it. And my hope is that as we grow up in our spiritual maturity, that we become people who are willing to set a basic level of need and assets to live on and then ask God, where do we give the rest of what we have away? Where do we invest it? What am I doing to train my children to be generous givers? I told you about these cards. I mentioned these before, but today we'll be giving our kids these promise cards, and I wonder if you would help them just give something, contribute something, and that they would start to kind of get up on their toddler legs and learn to give and to aim their giving. Most of us would, I think, find opportunities like this helpful as responsive givers and grateful givers, not guilty givers, but grateful givers. And these questions that we ask like this, am I hanging on to money excessively as a backup plan in case God fails me? That's another massive question that probes our hearts. So after leaving this world, some of us will be known as someone who accumulated treasures on earth that we couldn't keep. But then there are others of us who have said, we're going to finish strong. I'm going to be recognized as someone who invested my treasure in heaven, a treasure that we cannot lose. And as a church family, I want to call us to be careful not to leave our treasures stored behind, but instead to invest them ahead. Don't leave them stored away. When the Lord comes, what's going to happen to the money sitting in our bank accounts and in our retirement programs, the state and our foundations? It'll burn like wood and hay and straw, when it could have been exchanged for gold and silver and precious stones that never get corrupted, and money that could have been used to feed the hungry, fulfill the Great Commission, to strengthen and solidify our own church family and even beyond.